Thanks for joining me on the Sports in the Making podcast. I'm your host, Don Cardona. This is episode number 26. In sports, most of what we see goes on the air, but there are other facets of the sports business that help drive the viewer to watch those events, whether it be studio shows or live games. My guest on this episode has an impressive list of places she's put her marketing skills to practice, with companies such as Fox Sports, Universal Sports, and Red Bull. Allie Davis joins me to talk about what goes into marketing for sports networks, and we'll discuss her latest project, the Women's Tour de France, with her new company, Impact Partners. I use photos and video in this episode, so if you're listening, please be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel, Sports in the Making, to see some of what we discuss. Well, I can't think of anyone that I know that is a bigger fan of cycling than my guest today, and who is also a fantastic marketing executive. Allie is an award-winning senior marketing executive who has worked with a variety of sports networks, including E!, Fox Sports, Universal Sports Network, has worked for Red Bull, and has been an entrepreneur in media and marketing as well. And she joins me now. Thank you for joining me, Allie. How are you doing?
I'm good, Don. Thanks. It's nice to be reconnected.
Yeah. So you just got back from France. We can talk about that in a little bit. But what kinds of things are you doing right now?
So right now I'm doing a couple of things. I am executive producing a documentary on the Women's Tour de France, and also just launched a new women's sports media production and marketing company.
You've done a lot of this over your career, starting things pretty much from the beginning, I would say. How did that happen for you this time?
So as a marketer, I look for where there's a hole that I can fill. And if I can't find the hole, I have to look and say, well, who's in that space already? And is there something I can do better with whatever it is that I have in the moment, whether it's for somebody or myself? And in this particular moment in time, what I started to see out of my work with the documentary, the women's cycling documentary, is just the dearth of sports media coverage, storytelling, you name it, for women in sport. And as I dove deeper into that rabbit hole, I saw statistics like between 4 to 5%, depending on what survey you look at or study you look at, sports media coverage for women. And of that percentage, that pie, it's predominantly women's soccer. Then you have tennis, golf, WNBA, and you know, then you've got these other sports kind of like melting pot, of which cycling and softball, things like that, fall into. And then I saw that sports sponsorship dollars of that whole pie, 1% goes to women in sport. So seeing where we are now, thankfully to what the movement women's soccer has been able to do to really prove and show both fans and sponsors and TV networks, basically the whole sports ecosystem that you would find in a men's sport as well, that this is really viable. That was that opportunity that I saw for, with my background, understanding storytelling, the power of it, how to connect with audiences, a community, brands, basically make all of the stakeholders that support that ecosystem pay back in their investment that they're making into this.
That's one thing that I've come to learn about you in our brief interaction a few years ago, was the attention that you take into putting it into marketing and those branding and relationships. Talk a little bit about what goes into that beyond what you just mentioned, because I don't know if people understand a lot of really how much it entails, especially with a TV network, and how you're able to get that across.
So there's different stakeholders, and it's changing now. You know, and that's also part of how I ended up back out on my own again, is when I wanted to get back really into the heart of what I love doing, which is sports media production and marketing. I was trying to figure out what that looks like today, because our beloved network no longer exists. You know, the regional sports networks are in disarray and changing every day. Streaming platforms are just starting to, you know, muscle in and really become, I think, the new quote unquote TV provider. And so I was trying to figure it out, you know, where do I fit in that I can really support and help. But regardless, when you break it apart and you look at all of, again, those key stakeholders that support that platform, whether it is a TV network, cable network, streaming platform, you've got rights holders, you have athletes, you have your distribution team, you have your ad sales team, you've got your viewers. So I look at all of those different channels, if you will, and try to think about what is it that they need that I can do to support what they're trying to accomplish with whatever they've just invested in. What athletes are those star athletes? What brands do they connect with? How can I support those athletes with showing this event that we're showing? So I really look at it as a holistic 360 and see all the different dots that I can connect that are make everything efficient and only add value to what everybody's trying to do. Because we've all come to this one event for a reason. And at the end of the day, we all want it to be as positive, which includes making money off of it. You know, but we need the athletes to be successful. We need people to see it. We need to inspire future athletes so that there's a pipeline for great competitors down the road. You know, brands need to see that they've got value out of it. Rights holders need to say, like, wow, I chose the right platform to go with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
How did you get into sports and then find that way through the marketing arm of it?
It's a big giant accident and pile of following my passion. So I grew up in Northern California and was always athletic. My dad taught me how to throw a football and a baseball properly. So I could always get into a game and I loved playing sports. I loved just the feeling of movement and how I felt like my entire mind and body. I didn't, you know, obviously we know so much more about it today. But as a kid, I just love playing and love that freedom. I love competing. I love competition. And I always had this creative outlet where I thought I wanted to make movies. And eventually I ended up in LA. Although let me backtrack. I was up in San Francisco. I worked for an ad agency, tried to get into the creative department, but I was in the media buying department, which to this day, I am forever grateful that I had that experience. Could not get into the creative department, but my boyfriend at the time was competing in the world championship triathlon in Hawaii, the Kona Triathlon Ironman. And this is way back in the day when ABC Sports used to cover it, now ESPN. And I knew that I was going to be there for a while. ABC was covering it. I had a friend that knew a producer, and I said, hey, Sarah, I'm going to be there. He's acclimating. Do you think maybe they can put me to work? I know who all the athletes are because I followed the sport. And lo and behold, I get a paid job being a production assistant. And on the course in the assistant director's car because I could identify athletes and understood the race. And that was my holy crap moment. I can do this for a living. I did not know that this existed. And so I networked. I spoke with that director, the assistant director. I became friends with them. And one thing led to another, and I kept following the path and where it would take me. And if it took me to a place that eventually didn't work, I was fortunate to always have another opportunity kind of come my way. Or I chose to make one myself.
Well, once you're bitten by the sports bug and I would say the TV bug, it's hard to relieve that pain, if you will.
But it's also not for everybody. And, right. You know, I've had interns that have come in the door and I'll ask them, are you a sports fan? Because if you're not, you'll go crazy. My experience of working in sports is everyone in the building is a fan. And so during our breaks, during coffee time, during just running into each other in the hall, it's 24/7. We just love it. We can't help it. And so if you are not of like mind, you probably want to run your head through a wall.
Right. And so how did that early experience get you to Fox Sports as the director of marketing?
So let's see. So I went from, so the Ironman experience allowed me to decide to go freelance. And I got a few other paid gigs. I worked with NBC Sports on the St. Croix Triathlon, where I had an interesting brush in with a very young Lance Armstrong back in the day. And then I decided to move to LA and ended up working on entertainment, not in sport. But I was still an athlete myself, and training hard and working the hours that you have to work making movies don't really go well together. And I was miserable. I mean, I was an enigma on sets. People did not understand what I was about. Same thing, kind of going back to being surrounded by fans and people who are passionate about the same things you are. And so I was a little stuck in that moment and had to think about, well, what other industry do I want to be in? Because I had my hopes and dreams set on winning an Academy Award one day. I mean, that was really what I was excited about, making those kinds of great stories. And there was this regional sports publication called City Sports Magazine that started up in San Francisco. I ended up getting a job there. The guy that originally owned it and started it said to me, I don't care if you run, swim, bike to your clients, but I became a sales rep and sold retail ads. But what started to happen is I started to understand how to leverage and work with those clients, what they had, tied them into local events, worked with co-op dollars. So for example, it doesn't exist anymore, but down in LA, we have Sports Chalet, which was like a big REI type of a big sporting, higher end sporting goods store. And I did all the work, but basically said, you know, does Nike have co-op dollars? I'll go get them for you. And then we would create a full page ad that Nike would pay half for, essentially. Then I started to understand what kinds of content the readers were interested in, started to develop more of a content plan, and then created a section in the magazine called California Wheeling, which to no surprise was a cycling insert in the publication that came out quarterly. And from that, when that magazine was getting sold, I didn't believe in the buyers of the publication because, again, they weren't of this space that I felt they would have credibility. And you have to be, I know it's an overused word, but you have to be authentic in the sports space. You cannot fake it. It just, I didn't believe in that they were going to do what the publication should do. And so I started my own that went head to head with them. And that's kind of threw me into the trajectory, but I didn't really know the true business of magazine publishing because I came from what's called controlled circulation. So that means it's basically paid for by the advertisers and you drop it off at locations like gyms and REI and those kinds of places. Well, I used to drop it off at Prime Ticket, which was a regional sports network in Los Angeles that had the Lakers and the Clippers and the Dodgers, well, later the Dodgers, but the Angels and, you know, SC, UCLA. And when I realized I needed to fold the publication because I couldn't find a buyer for it and I couldn't continue on after 2 years of trying to sell ads, it's what's behind me. It was a very slick publication. I positioned it as the Rolling Stone MTV of health, sports, and fitness. I had some incredible talent around it, designing it and working with me on it. When I tried to sell it, I cannot remember exactly how it happened, but I reached out to Prime Ticket. Oh, I know what it was. I was in this moment of crap. Now what do I do? So I made a list of the places I would like to go work. I just wrote them down. Rolling Stone, MTV, Prime Ticket. And I can't remember the other ones, but basically I called them all. And Prime Ticket just happened to have a brand new position, marketing director. And they knew my magazine. One thing led to another. I got the job. Prime Ticket was then bought by John Malone of TCI, became Prime Sports. So I got to rebrand a sports network, Prime Sports. And then John Malone sold it to Rupert Murdoch. And then we launched the regional sports networks, and I launched Fox Sports West and Fox Sports West 2.
What goes into branding a network and then rebranding? Because that's a lot of things you have to worry about.
It's a lot of things you have to worry about. It goes back basically to the communications of all those key stakeholders between the rights holders, the team owners, the athletes, the ad sales clients, and the viewers, because you have to let them know. And it, you know, there's a lot to it between the logo redesign, you know, testing what does work, what doesn't work. Just, it's a lot of subjectivity. What do people want? What is the president of your network like? And then once you get your whole look and feel down, it's creating packages, marketing toolkits, basically, for all those different stakeholders that can help you let those different channels know that a change is happening. In a lot of cases, it's just, you know, it's only better. It's not different. It's just a new name. It's, and the Prime Sports one was like same home teams with the Fox attitude or something, you know, so just to help them understand it's only going to get better. Your viewing experience is going to be better. Ideally, you want to help people understand it's going to be a more premium experience, especially in the sports space, that especially when they're paying for
right. it. Yeah, it, because, I mean, you look at some of the big sports networks, Fox, ESPN, their branding is, it seems to be everywhere, but it's mostly within their coverage. But you also have to worry about outside the coverage of what people are tuning into. So activations and events outside of their locations. Can you talk about how something like that works and what your intent is on trying to make those types of engagements?
So with probably one of the most fun ones of those that we did was actually when we were launching Fox Sports West 2 with the Dodgers. So the Dodgers had never had all of their home games televised before. They had their own when they were still family owned. They had this philosophy that if the games are local games are televised, fans won't buy tickets. So we had a lot of negotiating happen, a lot of really great people on the front lines of that, convincing the O'Malley family that that would not be the case. And to launch the second sports network with the Dodgers, we, because not everybody had Fox Sports West 2, we brought the game to you. So we outsourced massive jumbotrons at some key locations throughout Southern California, all the way down to San Diego. We had in Century City up here in LA, which is one of the key markets, we brought people from the ballpark out. So there's a famous guy, Roger the Peanut Guy, who tosses peanuts in a really fun way. I think he's still there. We brought him out. We had water. We had, you know, Cracker Jacks. Like we just made a baseball experience. The Dodgers helped promote it. We bought advertising around it. We worked with radio stations, did radio promotions around it. I mean, you really, it's circling the wagons. And that's really marketing is, and I do believe a lot of it now is coming back to understanding how to ultimately make these really important connections with your communities, whether they're on a super small grassroots level or a global level. People are people wherever we go. And sports fans are sports fans wherever you go. We're all the same. That digital advertising, the kind of disarray it's in right now with data, privacy, cookies, you know, going away. Newer marketers who only understood how to tell a piece of digital creative to go find this consumer that I want are a little freaked out right now because they don't have all these skills of, a holistic marketing program. And being, you know, very, that's unfair to a lot of people to make that blanket statement.
In but general,
there's though. A lot of truth to it. Yeah, in general. That's what I also started to understand is really the power of, fortunately, what I've been able to create over the years of my experiences, really making those true connections. And again, with all the stakeholders, it's not just about your connection to your community. It's your connection with your brands, your partners, and your athletes and your rights holders. I mean, these are people that you want to build trust with so that they know that that you're looking out for them no matter what, because you care. You care. Right. And again, if you're not a sports fan, you can't fake that.
Right. And when you're talking about that relationships with the teams or any stakeholder, a sponsor, the relationship can only take you so far, but you also have to have the ideas and the creativity that goes into it. Where do those ideas come from? Is it generally generated by the marketing team, or is there a bigger aspect? Is it a meeting that people just throw ideas out and one sticks? How does that work?
All of the above. I mean, an idea can come from anybody. You know, I mean, an intern could walk in and say, you know, I have this idea. What do you think? And that's happened to me before. And the idea, I'll know that it won't work the way that it was brought to me, but I'll say, well, what would you think if we did this with it? But it's just taking a nugget of something. I've had brainstorming meetings. I've worked with agencies to come up with ideas. My bike is a really great place for me for creativity, to just clear my head and just go ride. And, you know, I'll stop along the way sometimes and have to, you know, record or write things down or send myself a note. It really just depends. It's never the same. And that's the other thing, is that I would never and don't ever treat any project that I'm working on the same as I've done with anything in the past, because every circumstance is different. I will for sure use and be informed by things that I've done in the past. So some of it might look similar, just with different colors and effects. But you really have to treat everything as though it were brand new coming into your space. And if you're creating something, if you are charged with creating an activation or a campaign, then it's best to get as many creative heads in a room that you can and kick some ideas around. But at the same time, give yourself deadlines. Because at the end of the day, you will ultimately have to make a decision and you'll have to move forward, or nothing will get done, because people can brainstorm all day long. It's a lot of fun.
So Ali, you mentioned that the digital marketing kind of has its place and still is, but it seems to be returning back to when you were with Fox Sports and the Dodgers and getting that marketing at the basic level back. Is that what I'm understanding?
Kind of. It's you know, really marketing today, just with, again, the deprivation of the third-party cookie, first-party data being essential, privacy concerns now, you know, throughout the world. The ways to reach people digitally is changing. And it has a lot of marketers concerned, because a lot of these people really grew up on just being able to code or tell a piece of technology with a really great piece of creative, go reach this person and have them make this transaction. Super simplifying, obviously. You know, what's happening because of all these changes is, you, in the last few years, you've had marketers on a little bit of a freak out, because they've been, in my humble opinion, lazy marketers. They forgot about all of these other avenues that you really need to have a holistic marketing program. And, you know, I'll give you kind of an interesting, maybe simmered down thought about it is, you know, we have these paper maps, right, that we learned how to drive or hike or navigate, you know, literally in our vehicles with. And then we get introduced to technology and we have, amazing, we have Waze, we've got Google Maps, we, you know, don't have to worry about getting lost. Well, have you ever had that technology die on you? Have you ever had to pull back out that map, that paper map, and go back to, thank God I know how to read a map, because this piece of technology just stopped working on me? It's again, I simplify, but it's going back to that, where you have to understand how to still make these connections to people without technology. And I understand it's going to get even more and more advanced with the promise of the metaverse and, you know, where it's going. But at the end of the day, and it may be part of also my hope for humanity, that we do stay connected. We stay connected together outside, not just participating in nature and in sport, but just that we look up from our phones. And don't forget to make those human connections, because at the end of the day, again, you know, that's the most powerful marketing that you'll ever have.
A little bit ago, we were talking about what's a garden wall. Is that what
a
it's called?
A walled garden.
Wall garden.
Yeah.
And so, what is that?
So basically it's where a publisher, like what Outside is doing or what Condé Nast might be doing, where they own their first party data. So if you are an advertiser and you want to reach this particular demographic for whatever reason, you now have to go through that publisher and pay them directly to have access to their audience. So that's, again, where it's, to me, it's just kind of going back to where we were, where if you wanted to buy advertising on Monday Night Football, you go to whatever network has Monday Night Football. You know, you would buy ads in the newspaper, you'd buy ads on the radio, you know, now there's podcasts, now there's satellite radio, now there's just more media to buy. But at the end of the day, it's all about understanding how to get to first party data, that person. You want to get to that person, and technology, and again, that what's happening behind the scenes with technology and all the changes with privacy and the whole cookie situation, it's just getting harder and harder to do it from that position of where marketers had it. So, you know, quite honestly, it was a luxury. And it, as a result, though, the way that marketing was operating in the last several years, it's completely fragmented what marketers do. So it created marketing silos. And you would have a social media marketer. You would have a digital marketer. You would have a, you know, content marketer. And they weren't even all reporting into the same person, which to me was like mind-boggling, that you wouldn't have all of those different units connected, because at the end of the day, they should all be working off the same strategy towards the same goal. And a lot of times they're just not. So having people help who understand really how to, you know, be a conductor of an orchestra, of a marketing orchestra that has to all play together to make beautiful music. That's really what we do.
Yeah, it's really interesting how the more things change, the more they eventually come to stay the same.
But I mean, you know, and the last thing I'll leave you with that is, you know, I have, whether or not I've been working in television throughout my career, I love the business, again, of media and sports. So I follow it no matter what. And when I remember when I was starting out in cable, when I was just a little baby, you know, people were freaked out about these new satellite companies coming in and, you know, oh, our world, our beautiful world, it's crumbling. And okay, then we made room for satellite. And then the telco providers came in, you know, and now the streamers. And the streamer, you know, platforms are, in my opinion, again, now just new TV providers. You know, they just have their bundles are going to look different. You might be able to bundle in, you know, a connected fitness and music and your TV instead of just your internet and your TV and whatever else the traditional cable providers used to bundle in. So it's just a new way of looking at it. And we just, you know, we evolve.
So after Fox Sports, you had a couple of stops, one being E, as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast. How is that different from sports? I know it's entertainment and it all falls under the same umbrella, but is there a difference between sports and entertainment?
Most definitely in that case. I mean, that was hardcore entertainment. And I think a few things. What excited me about that network were the people who worked inside those walls. They were amazing. It was very family oriented. I had a boss and then an Uber boss, and my Uber boss was a cyclist. So we would ride together and have meetings. We would get an in-house feed in July and watch the Tour de France together in his office. So I think that I had enough of that fed me on the side. And there were two networks. There was the E Entertainment Network and the Style Network that was more of a basically like what you see today on those home improvement shows, interior, exterior type of things. There were some changes over at E where then stopped to be that kind of fun environment for me, and it got super hardcore entertainment, and that's when I left, because it just I couldn't do it anymore. It wasn't what I was about, and it was right when the Kardashians were launching, to give you a point of reference, and where the network went to. So it wasn't for me anymore, and I couldn't do my best work for them.
And so then you became an entrepreneur, starting your own marketing agency. What are some of the challenges in doing that coming from corporate?
It's risk-taking for sure, strategic risk-taking. I did it with a business partner who had experience on the radio promotion side of the world. And so it really came about from both of us having, she did radio promotions for me when I was at E. So I had worked with her quite a bit. We became good friends, and we were both going through a similar experience of the company that we were working for was changing character, and we weren't feeling connected to that anymore. And we just started to throw out, what if we took what we do for me to other networks and help them launch their shows, and movie studios with their films. And we started talking about what that might look like. And it was great because I understood the person on the other side of the desk that needed this kind of support. We had case studies about what we both just did together that were very effective. And we just decided to create a partnership. We structured it. We each had a lane that we swam in, so to speak. And off we went, we had a great network already in place of people that, same thing, friends with a lot of people or people that were known, or one of us knew somebody or the other person, one of us would get a meeting, bring the other along. And it was great. We did that for, I think, 4 years before, you and I got to meet and work together.
Well, and that's where I was going next, because your next stop happened to be the network that I started with as well. But you were there a little bit longer with than I was, Universal Sports Network. How did you get there, and what kinds of things did you do?
So I had that network on I had a home office. So my business partner, Ellen, and I, who's now still my very good friend, and she still has our business. It's still going. We worked out of our homes, both really were self-starters. We actually, it's almost, to a fault where we would wake up and say hi to each other, and we were the last people we'd say goodbye to each other because we were burning candles on both ends. I was missing sports. We were doing a lot of entertainment. We were working with HBO and Showtime and NBC. And I mean, you name the show, and we basically, we touched a lot of really amazing shows and films. And but I just miss sports. I was just missing it. And I started to connect with people just to kind of check in and say hi. And I noticed what I was doing. I also, in my home office, had a TV that I used for watching pilots. And it was connected to digital. And I just started to flip around one day just playing. I was just like, what are all these weird little channels, like, 20.5. And on 4.4 was this World Championship Sports Network. And I would leave it on as just company in my office because it had swimming and triathlon and cycling and basically every sport I love. I ended up going on a bike ride. And on the ride with my friend, there was another friend of hers who I did not know. And I overheard her saying, I'm starting a new job next week. And it's like, oh, what job are you starting? And she said, World Championship Sports Network.
Isn't
and
that funny?
I said to her, I go, oh my God, Jenny, it was Jenny Carlson. I said, Jenny, yeah. you are so lucky. You are not going to work for anything better ever in your life than a sports network. And I just remember that feeling of being jealous and sad and wanting. I wanted that. And I reached out. So they rebranded Universal Sports Network. I didn't know how that all came about. That, that was shortly after I discovered it. And then I realized David Sternberg had taken over as the president of the network, and I happened to know David. So I reached out and I let him know what I was doing with my marketing company and said, you know, look, with my background in sports, what I do, both understanding it as an athlete, as a viewer, and in business, maybe my agency can help you with what you're trying to do with Universal Sports.
And David, so he said, just to interject here, David was the CEO of the network at the time.
Yep. And came from Fox Sports Americas. He has a massive sports background too. And I actually had done some business back in the day at Fox Sports with his wife, Julie Sternberg, who used to run the tennis out of UCLA Tennis. So David said, great, let me connect you with my head of marketing and you know, see if you can get something done. I will not name names on that one, but it took months for that meeting to happen. And when we finally got that meeting and we went and met with her, I could tell out of the gate she wasn't a sports fan and was miserable and didn't seem like she understood, in my opinion, an incredible gem that she was sitting on. When I left, I followed up with David and, you know, he asked me what I thought and I just gave him my assessment of the network and I did not expect what was come out of his mouth, but he basically said, you know, you're spot on and, I now have that position available. You want to come in and talk? And I just said, yes. Because it was, you know, again, my favorite kind of content, the opportunity to scale a business, which I love, in the business of television. And I figured I'll figure out my partnership afterwards. So I went in and got the job. I mean, you know, it was just one of those, again, you kind of know and you know. And understood really the challenges that they were, you know, real headwinds that they were facing and understand, you know, and understood how to create a strategy and a path forward with that. I felt horrible with my business partner, but again, this was just I had to go do this. And she understood, and, you know, it took a minute, but again, she's like a sister to me. She's amazing. So, it all worked out.
Well, you had a calling. And I find it interesting that a lot of the things that you're talking about so far and how you've progressed have been networking. How important is networking? How do you do it? How can you do it properly? If there is a right answer to that, by the way.
I think everybody has their own style of it. I think the most important thing is to be your real self with people, because I consider, you know, what's called a network, I consider friends and people that if they called me for something and needed something, I would do anything I could to help them. And, you know, you find out the ones, I think that there's different levels of where people are able to have the bandwidth, have the desire, whatever it is. And you just kind of, I think, figure out who's in your, you know, your close-knit group and who's in that next one and that next one. And, you know, when you have to reach to that outer verse of it, you hope that you somehow have a way to connect back in, that it's not awkward. So you don't feel like you're just reaching out because you need something. I hate that feeling. That's just something I avoid at all costs. So it's just about, you know, maintaining and staying in touch with people, but only if you really want to, because if you don't, and it comes off very salesy, and that's just not what I'm about. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, I just feel like I was just actually messaging with somebody who I worked with all through the Prime Ticket window, and, you know, several decades later, we're still friends. And just, it doesn't mean that we're talking all the time, but we check in with each other every once in a while, you know, and it's a great feeling to just know that there's people out there who, you know, are in these amazing other places in their lives, but you still matter on some level to them, and they matter to me.
I'm glad you said that because I feel the same way about you. We hadn't talked since, 2015, more or less, when our network closed down and became NBC Sports. But I called you a few weeks ago just to ask for maybe some advice on distribution for my film, and we spent an hour and a half talking. And so I feel exactly the way you just described it is, you know, this industry is very tight knit. It's very small, but the relationships that come out of it aren't just work related. It's something beyond that. And it's like a day doesn't go by where it's like you just talked to each other yesterday.
And I think that comes from sharing the same passion. And I don't know what it's like in other industries because sports have really been most of my career intentionally. So I would like to think that exists in other arenas, but I think sports are pretty unique in the sense, again, that we're all passionate, super passionate, crazy passionate about what we do.
And now getting to what I'd mentioned earlier about how we know each other, I started with Universal Sports as a coordinating producer in Denver, and you were based in LA running all the marketing. What about Universal Sports Network for people who may not have seen it? Because it was kind of a niche product and it was not readily available to all platforms. How would you describe Universal Sports Network and what did that network mean for you?
Universal Sports was the Olympic Endurance and Action Sports Network. And if you were a fan of any of those types of sports, chances are we had programming for you. I also found that through the experience of that network that the USOC and all the national governing bodies, so USA Swimming, USA Ski and Snowboard, USA Cycling, etc., they were valuable partners for us as well because a lot of our viewers were what I consider a lean forward sports viewer versus somebody like if you're watching the NFL or the WNBA or NBA where you're going to be sitting back and watching the action. Viewers would watch our network, take pointers, see what's going on, and then go apply to their own sport or get inspired. A lot of our viewers or their children were members of those national governing bodies. So it was a really interesting connection, which for me, that was one of the things that I loved is that the network was very much alive. So if, you know, you walked to a swim meet or a world championship ski event or you name it event or the Tour de France or any other big cycling event, the network was part of that. And it felt very connected to it and an important part of it, which is what I loved. I love that. I mean, that was the magic for me was really getting to be part of, again, that holistic group of entities that come together for something.
Yeah, and I came from stick and ball world, football, basketball, baseball. So this was my first job that put me outside of my comfort zone. And it took me a little while to understand how intricate these sports are and the connections and the athletes and the way things are done. For me, it was very rewarding because not only did I get outside my bubble, but I got to experience the Olympics every year. And I didn't think that even existed. It's not every 4 years, you know, staggered winter or summer. Every two, but for me, it was an experience that I'll never forget because of the network working with, you know, the people in my production team, working with you out there in LA, and just coordinating all that stuff. It was a lot of fun. Is that how would you describe it from your perspective?
I think that's right, and I, you know, for me, the Olympics were one part of it for sure, and that was one of the actually the strategies that we used for marketing the network to fans of the Olympics, especially as it was coming closer in time, you know, with the World Championships or other big events that were happening that might decide what athletes go to the Summer Games or the Winter Games, and to help viewers understand. Hey, if you want to know how that athlete, that journey that athlete took to get there, it all unfolds on our network. So if you really want to see, like, if you're a real fan of this sport and you really want to get, like, the understanding what behind it, not just watch great competition, you know, come over here. And then we also had some of the shoulder content around it as well, which that was the other part that I loved, is I got to really express my creativity as a content developer as well, you know, coming up with whether they were vignettes or we, you know, we tried a lot of different things. We did the, in fact, I just found it the other day and it made me laugh and cringe all at the same time. It was, we put Nick Gismondi in situations of Olympic athletes. Were you, I keep trying to remember what we called that. Like,
train train like a champion was Sochi. Yeah, but it was very similar to that. Yeah,
it was similar. And the one that, you know, it's like, how much food does Michael Phelps eat? You know, can Nick eat that much? And, the one that was crazy was we put Nick on a pitch with Todd, oh gosh, the rugby player, two rugby players from Team USA, and Nick kind of got hurt, but was such it was just an amazing
Todd Clever. Piece of- Todd Clever.
Todd Clever. Yeah, Todd Clever. It was awesome. And, you know, and you look at some of the shows that are out there now and you see, you know, I don't know whether or not people saw these things or not, probably not. A lot of people have the same idea, but it makes me happy to see that, you know, they were effective and people did enjoy them and they did what they were supposed to do.
As part of marketing, it's not, again, not just what goes on the air, but outside of it. I have an example here. You may remember of this, cycling sign that had to have come from your department. But I've had that since the network closed down. And I see right behind you, you have a USA or the Rugby World Cup ball. Talk about some of the marquee events that take place on a network and what your mission is from the marketing team to help drive viewers.
Rugby World Cup was really different because it had its own carve out in all of our distribution deals as a pay-per-view product as well. So, you know, my goal as a marketer is, again, there's multiple goals, but at the end of the day, it's driving revenue, value and revenue for the stakeholders and ultimately for your business. For Rugby World Cup, we had to help people in the U.S. understand what it was and why they should care about it and why they should spend money on it. And we were lucky to have that twice in our time at the network. And I would say that we did an incredible job the second time. As you recall, it was in London, so the time zone was better than the first go around. We helped explain rugby better. We did like the Monty Python riff, you and Dean and the guys like created those whole great, you know, vignettes that then the sales guys could go sell, which were great. And made it super entertaining. And that, I think we increased our revenue like 4x or something like that in that second round with Rugby World Cup. But also importantly is we made that sport matter. And I think to our own demise in a certain way, we had NBC, the mothership, and ESPN now bidding for Rugby World Cup rights after nobody wanted to touch rugby. So mission accomplished. We drove revenue. We drove revenue for our, you know, pay-per-view distribution partners. We supported all the rugby teams. We supported the rugby union. We made rugby matter in the United States. The brands that came along had really great partnership programs because, again, it was this clean slate that kind of what you're seeing with women's sports right now, where it's not cluttered so much. So we were able to do some extra special things with that and super successful. And then another one is Boston Marathon, where that was another really special and horrifying moment in time where we all, you know, our network had the marathon on during the bombings and we had to go into kind of this crisis mode and first and foremost, make sure everybody of our crew were safe and sound because you guys were right near where I think the second bomb went off. And
yeah,
I mean, we had our head of sales was running it, and it went off right after he went over the finish. I mean, it was crazy on every single level possible, and we still were on the air. And so it was managing that, and then being part of the investigation afterwards, handing over footage, things like that. But then it was really working with the Boston Marathon, the BA, the association, and helping them bring back the event and making people feel really good. And how could we as a partner help them with what they were trying to accomplish? And we came up with this idea of, could we make the marathon that day? Could we get all of the TV providers that you would normally have to pay your monthly subscription to? Could we get them to open up our channel for free for that day of the race, so that everybody in the United States that wanted to watch that marathon and feel part of it could be? And that was the We Run for One campaign that we came up with, where it was really all about, we're all coming together. This is a really important event in our country, for the world. We're not going to let it stop us. I mean, there were so many, you know, parts of that mattered, of bringing it back. And it was an honor to be part of that, and really helping the BAA, you know, kind of get back to their business and making people feel safe and want to participate and moving on, you know, as we did, sports and healing.
Right. And my recollection from that following year, because that's really, I mean, we were pretty much done with coverage and then they shut everything down. But when you lead up into the next year, it is months and months of preparation, because that's where all the eyeballs are for the next year. And you got to be sure that every single detail, as far as wording goes, you know, you have to be sensitive to the people who are affected, the whole city really, but marathoners in general, and how to put together the tees and then the coverage and then everything after that. And one of the things I remember about being there was this sense of hope going into that next year instead of the somberness from the year before. And I think marketing played a huge part in that. You're not just trying to get eyeballs to watch. You're also trying to have to treat it with a certain amount of dignity and make that message right, so it's not, you're not making it feel like you're exploiting that.
100%. And, you know, we brought in the, a lot of the victims, who some of them were running again, although they may have, you know, become an amputee because of the bombing, or they couldn't run anymore, but they want to be part of it. I mean, there was a lot of healing and care that had to go into this. And again, that's when I talk about being real with sports, because it's, I mean, that's a terrible example of it, but anything can happen at events, and you just have to be prepared. I mean, nobody prepared any of us for that. And so there was, again, like really no roadmap forward. So we all had to lean on each other and, you know, check in with each other. How are you doing? You know, both because you were there and that must have been a terrible experience, but then also, what do you think about this message? Is this coming across in the right tone that we're trying to deliver to people? And we just want to feel like we're part of the conversation in the community, not something that is trying to capitalize upon a moment in time, especially something like that. But really, you know, working with the first responders, and we just brought everybody involved back in. And I think that was helpful for them too, to be able to share their experience as part of their, I don't even know if you call that heal. I mean, it was so horrific, but it seemed to help with them through their own work that they had to, and I'm sure still are dealing with.
No, and it definitely did. And I think, you know, I hope that we were a part of that healing process and in helping to recognize what happened, but then to advance really what marathon is about and what sports is about. So I know you had a big part in that. And so, you know, that's part of why I wanted you on, is to recognize some of the things that you've done in your career. So you know, Universal Sports became NBC Sports, you had to move in a different direction. And shortly after, you went to Red Bull as their VP of integrated marketing. What is integrated marketing?
Dot connecting. I mean, honestly.
Exactly really, what we just described?
Exactly. What it's literally, it was, how do I take, what the can side of the business is trying to do. So the actual energy drink, what the media house side of the business. So the films, the TV network, they were launching Red Bull TV, their athletes, their artists, you name it. You know, how do we take all of the entities that make up the world of Red Bull and leverage in a moment in time some of those tactics, if you will, that make sense, that will drive everybody's business forward. And it was great, but it's a massive, massive, massive company. And it's really hard to get some of the bigger ideas done because at the end of the day, that company really is a marketing company and one of the best in the world. It was also interesting when I first started working there, I had a really hard time understanding what everybody really did. And one of my colleagues said to me, Allie, everybody here is a marketer. And as soon as she said that, a light bulb went off in my head because then I understood how to interact with them and how to talk with them and how to also make them understand I'm only here to help you. Connect this third party brand, bringing it into the world of Red Bull. I want to make whatever it is that you're working on better. I want to enhance it. But then it would get through all those hoops and then go to legal and die. It's just too hard to work with those with really blue chip. It's really hard.
Well, it seems like they have the wheels in motion and you're just jumping on, right?
Yeah. For sure.
You mentioned branding and marketing in the last answer that you gave. What is the difference between the two when it comes to sports? Is there any?
And they really are connected because you can't brand without marketing, and to market you need a brand. So it's brand is the identity of what it is that you want people to see, learn, be aware of, have a good feeling for, what's the tone of it? What are the colors? Really just how it's displayed to you and the feeling that you want people to walk away with. The marketing is what fuels it.
When you're at the VP level, what are your primary responsibilities as opposed to at the director level and maybe even that mid part of those positions?
It's a lot of management. It also really depends on the company that you're at and the size of the company that you're at, because a lot of times people will just say it's just a title. A lot of times that is true, but the way that some of these bigger corporations are set up, that title brings with it a certain salary range, bonus plan, different perks that you might get being a VP versus a director. So there are important reasons, to earn those titles, whether you're coming in fresh from outside or you're working your way up the ranks. But it really does depend on the size of the company, because, a VP at Red Bull could be like an executive, whatever, C-suite at another company. I mean, I wasn't, but it's not apples to apples, wherever you go, for sure.
Okay. And then again, at the top of the show, I mentioned your love of cycling. Cycling seems to be taking you in your next venture. You did mention the documentary. Tell me a little bit more about what the documentary is, how you plan to get it out there, and maybe some of the challenges that you've experienced with this documentary.
So just as a run-up to the documentary, when I left Red Bull, I became business partners with a Red Bull athlete, Rebecca Rush, who is a 7-time world champion, most known for her mountain biking. So I just want to acknowledge that because, again, it was my love of cycling and she has a big gravel event. And so it was, you know, again, understanding her brand, the sports, the story, creating more content, things like that. The way that I ended up in this position now that I'm in is I had a minute to think about what I wanted to do next. And I really, once again, it was kind of like when I was missing sports back when I found you guys at Universal Sports Network. It was, I missed it. I really missed it. And I missed media. I missed production. I missed being in trucks with you guys. I mean, that's one of my most favorite places to be is, you know, actually in the truck when you guys are doing your thing. But I didn't know what it looked like today because it's all changed so much. And again, regional sports networks, not what they used to be. Like we talked about before, you know, Hulu, Apple, like everybody's starting to get now into sports, but those are like behemoth companies that I don't think I do my best work in those kinds of large organizations because I really like to make a lot of things happen for a lot of different people in the sport. I had said to my husband, you know, one of the things I would like to do at some point in my career is make a documentary. I just don't know the topic. And I started to network again because, again, I was trying to figure out how do I fit into this new world that we're in with sports rights and streaming and broadcast and whatever we're calling it. And I happened to read one of my newsletters that, you know, it's like hit or miss when you open these things because not, I don't know about you, but I certainly cannot keep up with my inbox and all the things that I feel like I should read, but I can't get to. But I happened to open this one and I read about this woman who just started a new podcast on an NPR station that was Eclectic Sports. And I figured, oh, I'll just reach out to her. You know, I know a bunch of really interesting eclectic athletes. Maybe she'd be interested in some of them. And I just sent her an invite on LinkedIn and she responded right back with a message that said, I'd love to learn more about your background and tell you about this documentary film I'm directing about the women's Tour de France.
You just fell right into it, accidentally, I on purpose.
I kind of fell off my chair when I read it, to be honest with you, because I was just like, wait, what? And so, you know, for me, when, both as a cyclist, as a woman in the sport, as somebody who at Universal Sports Network, I got, you know, to get to experience through NBC's coverage of, you know, and then our second window or our first window, whether it was the Tour de France or the Giro d'Italia, or the Vuelta a España, you know, the three Grand Tours, all of these classics. In 2014, there was a group of women who were very vocal about bringing back women's racing at that level at the Tour de France, and put pressure on the event organizer. And I, on the inside of the network, you know, advocated that we televise it. And the ASO, the event organizer of the Tour de France, came back with La Course by Tour de France, which was a one-day women's event. And we did all kinds of things around it on the network side. Again, just trying to do whatever we could from the position we were in to help USA Cycling, to help ASO, to help women, you know, all these athletes. And it left as fast as it came because there wasn't the commitment from the event organization, from the sponsors, you know, the dollars there, you know, again, the pipeline of athletes, it takes an entire village to make these things really, really work. So I explained to Jill my background and how I have been kind of threaded through women in sport, including being one of those young female athletes who only had men that inspired me in the sport, like Andy Hampstead and Greg LeMond, because I never saw the women. I didn't know that Connie was racing until I think it was the 84 Olympics when I first saw women racing for the first time. And it was unfortunate, but I understood it, right? So Jill and I started talking and really talked about the importance of these women of the 80s. So from 84 to 1989, there was a women's Tour de France and nobody knows about it. And again, it went away because the whole ecosystem for women's sport was not invested in it. And I said to Jill, look, you know, it's coming back this year. So women's sports is on this little, I think, true moment again. But I do think this time it's we have more traction than we've ever had in my experience and seeing it throughout my decades. That we wouldn't be here today with this current peloton of these incredible female athletes if it weren't for those women of the 80s. And we need to tell this story, but help them understand and make that connection for them so they understand the origin story of where we are today. So that's what we've been developing and working on. And we went to France this year to shoot more interviews around with some of the women from today's peloton and some other key members around the race itself to bring it all together. But Jill's already, she had already done quite a bit of work with the women from the 80s. She herself also raced in the 80s.
When I saw the trailer on your LinkedIn page a couple months ago, I think maybe on your Facebook page as well, but let's take a quick look at it.
Et c'est l'Américaine Marianne Martin qui remporte ce premier Tour de France féminin.
It was like a dream.
I loved representing my country. I loved going to the Tour de France.
They said women couldn't survive the Tour de France.
The women will not make it to the finish line without one casualty. We proved them wrong. There was so much excitement. We had this love for cycling. We had this love for racing. We were at the Tour de France. We were honored to be there.
I was on the same podium as the men. It was amazing. We were pioneers. I rode my heart out. There was great camaraderie among the riders.
The Olympics are one day. With the Tour, it was every day. It was living.
I think most people don't even know there was a Women's Tour de France.
All these years later, I still have that same joy on the bike.
The women of the Tour de France will never be forgotten.
Do the women run the same course as the men, or is it altered in any way?
It's really important for your audience and other sports viewing audiences to understand that women's sports is not the same as men's sports, and that's exactly how we want it. The women of the 80s rode the same number of stages as the men, but they were shorter distances. So what would happen, though, imagine this. You get to the bottom of a climb, and you're one of the male competitors, and you've had 30, 50... 70 miles to warm up to get to this massive climb. The women were dropped right at the bottom and just had to go. You know, not setting anybody up for greatness. But they did it. They, you know, and they did it on heavy old bikes and one kit for the entire race and no training or sleep and, you know, just paid their own way. I mean, you'll learn more about it in our film. And today they brought back the women's race. It was an 8-day stage event. It started in Paris. It finished out about 3 hours or so outside of Paris in the mountains, not easily accessible. You know, I wished it would have finished in Paris. I think that would have been more authentic to the race, the heritage itself. But okay, you know, we have a foot in the door. We're back. I cannot tell you over the course of my experience with this documentary, when I'm talking to people in the cycling industry, and I mean in it again for a very long time, at some point in the conversation, they will say to me, you know, Allie, the women's racing is actually more exciting than the men's. And it is because it's shorter. It is, there's no time for lollygagging. I mean, there was in, I think it was in stage I think it was in stage two this year. There were a couple of horrific crashes. And it was really interesting because you hear people all around instantly say, oh, that's going to be bad for women's sport. You know, people are going to think like, oh, they don't know how to race their bikes or getting these accidents. Well, I was down by the winner of that stage at the end, and I heard her talk about what was going on. And she said, it was insane. Like, these women were racing so incredibly competitively and fierce. The teams were trying to organize. The road was narrowing, and there were side winds. Okay, day two of a grand tour that is resurfaced after 30-something years. You know, the men get in just as many accidents when the tours start because there's jitters and you've got to settle and you've got to find your, you got to get, you know, in your zone. But it's, you know, we just get scrutinized for whatever it is that we do, you know, and so it is, again, important that people understand it's different racing. We race different. We look different when we're racing. Our courses might kind of look the same. There might be the same rules, but don't compare it to the men's racing because, you know, you're not going to do anybody a service by doing that.
Right. And just my experience with La Course, I noticed a difference in the intensity is the same. The strategies are probably pretty much the same as a relatively as somebody who, you know, knows cycling a little bit better now because I did work at Universal Sports, but it was exciting. I would agree with you on that. And I do remember in Rio, the cycling was, there was a lot of storylines happening in that too on the Olympic cycling. So it's something that I think people should definitely watch if they haven't, and they'll see that it's its own brand, I think, of cycling.
Oh, for sure. And it was, you know, I was so eager to learn what the overnight numbers were this year. And I saw one of the sponsors who I thought might have access to that information. And so I went up to him and I said, you know, is there any information on what happened? And all they had at that moment was France TV. And basically, I think it was like, these numbers are not exactly right, but basically it was like the men's race did 2.4 million and the women's did 2 million, you know? So the audiences were there. When we came home, I was talking to some of our former colleagues at NBC, Peacock, and asked them the same question, you know, how were the numbers, knowing that they weren't going to give me the streaming numbers. But what they told me is that it exceeded their expectations, and which is basically the general sense is, this year's race exceeded expectations, and so thank God, because it's proving, just as women's soccer has proven, just as the WNBA, which I think is still trying to really prove and show, but the value is there, that, you know, these sports matter, and they bring in audiences, and we're seeing that in the studies that the younger audiences want to see more women's sports. So anybody that wants, yeah, that's the holy grail, right? For brands, yeah, and everybody else, like the new consumer.
Right. And that's good to hear because, like you said before, they haven't been recognized as much, but that doesn't mean that they don't exist. So what's the plan for the documentary? When can we see it? How's the progress?
So our goal with it, our distribution strategy, is to really work with all the global TV rights holders of the women's pro racing through ASO and have this film be on their platforms leading into the Women's Tour de France. So the best example that I give people, because so many people are aware of it right now, whether or not they even watch it, is Netflix and Drive to Survive and the impact that's had on Formula One, that these stories really matter so that people understand and learn about, again, the origin of the sport, make the viewer smarter, get them engaged, get them to understand who these athletes are, just like the Olympics are, you know, genius with NBC, you know, has been doing it for years. When the Olympics run up, you learn all about these athletes. And it makes you then want to go see them and how they do in their competition. So that's the plan, is to have it sometime in the spring of 2023 to coincide with the big, big real push of cycling season.
The film is called?
Uphill Climb, The Women Who Conquered the Impossible Race.
And what types of things will we see in that from a historical perspective?
You're going to learn a lot about the women from the 80s, not just the North American women, but women from all around the world. They used to race on national teams, not on trade teams. And we have some great interviews with these women from the past. I think people will also be surprised to learn that Greg LeMond was not the first American to win the Tour de France. It was Marianne Martin. And you'll learn a little bit more about, you know, the disparity, you know, between you know, what these women went through and really just their grit and determination, to do it.
Well, knowing what I know about you, your background, I found out more about you on this podcast, of course. I can't wait to see it, because I know that you'll, you know, anything that you touch is pretty much elite. So I can't wait to see it. So Allie, tell me what Impact Partners is all about.
So I just launched Impact Partners out of the film, Uphill Climb film, the documentary, because again, just being on the front line and researching and seeing all the data and information about women in sport and understanding, you know, we talked about the hole and filling the hole. That with only 4 or 5% of all sports media coverage being women in sport, and only 1% of sports sponsorship dollars going to women's sports, and understanding the power of women's sports. Melissa Forman, who is a former Fox Sports producer for many years, and she's produced long form and short form. She's Emmy winning. She's won a Clio. We've come together because we both feel that at this point in our careers, we really want to have a positive impact, and we understand what is needed to help move the needle in this arena for women in sports. So we launched Impact Partners basically to really tell compelling and powerful, inspiring stories about all these different female athletes and help, again, that, you know, we talk about the ecosystem and fuel it, because when you tell these stories and people start to get invested and engaged and learn about these sports and these incredible people and what they're doing, and maybe they're, you know, what they've overcome to get to the place of what they're doing, the platforms that have bought into the rights for these events are happier, and the brands and the sponsors and everybody's happier, and the athletes themselves get the exposure that they so deserve and have to have. And then there's this really incredible ripple effect, which is what it has on younger girls, and quite frankly, people, because I know that you don't have to be a young girl to be inspired by a woman. When I was working with Rebecca Rush, one of the best moments I had, there were a couple of them where I had an older man and a 17-year-old boy separately say to me, "I want to be like Rebecca Rush." And I thought, that's amazing that a man feels comfortable, not that they, I shouldn't even have to say this, but that they feel okay saying, she's a badass, and I wish I could be like that. But, you know, when young girls are inspired to play, amazing things happen with them. You know, they become empowered. They learn all kinds of skills. There's another incredible statistic that 95% of all C-suite women share one thing in common, that they all played a sport. So we believe that the more of these stories that we can tell, that we can help really grow women in sport as a whole, inspire more athletes, which again fills that pipeline. We get better competition, more fun to watch. Sponsors, you know, see that there's an opportunity there. That it will again just pay dividends all around and have a really positive impact ultimately on the world.
Yeah, it sounds really great what you're doing. So congratulations.
Thank you. We're super excited about it.
Before I let you go, I have a couple more questions. Since we're talking about sports and the marketing, what is your favorite sports movie?
So my favorite sports movie, I think I'll say I have three.
Okay.
The League of Their Own, because just amazing, and touches my heart in so many ways. Loved Moneyball. Love. I love Jonah Hill, so I'll see anything that he's in, but I thought that he and you know, I may or may not also love Brad Pitt, but the I really like True Story more, you know, I mean, it's not a documentary, but I like the stories that are told that were somewhat real. And I will also have to put Jerry Maguire on that list for one reason only, and this might be a cocky reason, but I'm proud of it, is they actually used one of my campaign creatives in Jerry's office for his sports agent office. So I felt, you know, I'm this close to Tom Cruise.
Now I have to go watch the movie again to see what it is. So yeah, no, that's great. Okay. So final question. What kind of advice would you have for anybody who's looking to get into sports marketing, in terms of really understanding how to navigate the business?
You know, it's a good question, and it really depends on the level that you're coming in at. If you are young and new and, you know, just setting out on your career, I think internships are amazing. I think it's really going to the teams, the outlets, the colleges, the whatever you have your own passion for, and knocking on those doors. If you're switching careers, it's, you know, really looking at what you're doing today. There are some roles that other people have that I think they would be surprised to learn that they actually market. I mean, you marketed, Don. You know, you understood. We would work together. You understood what audiences wanted. You understood that we needed to work with brands and help brands achieve. You were brainstorming, you know. It's how do you take those skills that you have and look at them slightly differently through a marketing lens, and how do they translate into marketing? But I would say, first and foremost, make a list of what types of sports you're interested in. And then drill down there, and you know, what are they Olympic sports? Are they action sports? Are they stick and ball sports? And then what brands are associated with them? What athletes are associated with? I mean, there's so many ways that you can get in, because every single point of contact for a sport needs marketing.
And it doesn't just happen from the marketing department, is what you're saying.
And it doesn't just happen from the marketing department. And if you're in a place where you want to learn marketing, you know, just go take your marketing people out for, you know, we like coffee. Go take them out for coffee.
Allie, I can't thank you enough for joining me on this podcast. Hopefully people learned a little bit about your world and what you've got coming up. You're a fantastic person to me. I always enjoyed working with you and brainstorming and being creative. So thank you for that. And again, thank you for joining me. It's been a great time.
Thanks, Don. Really fun.
I hope you enjoyed hearing Allie Davis' story. She's been a part of shaping how audiences tune into sporting events for most of her career. I've seen firsthand her marketing talents and how she uses her creativity to make each event special. Be sure to look for her latest project, the documentary, Uphill Climb, sometime in the near future. For more Sports in the Making podcast episodes, visit our YouTube page, Sports in the Making Podcast, or take a listen on your favorite audio podcast platform. Also be sure to check out Twitter at Sports Making, as well as the Facebook page. Thank you for listening to Sports in the Making. I'm Don Cardona.